Unpack your knives and stay. Yes, stay for the Nashville version of the Top Chef Kentucky Judges Roundtable podcast here on Reality TV Wrap-Ups. Hey, everybody. Mike Bloom here with a great panel of people hoping to make some sweet, sweet music in your ears as we discuss the 9th episode of Top Chef Kentucky. Let's go around and introduce ourselves. And you know what? I think we found an interesting discussion point from Michelle's vagaries with her own song choice. Kirk Clark, what's your favorite Beatles song?
Ugh. Help.
Is that a command or the name of the song?
It's both. It actually is like that and Hey Jude are probably two of my favorite, but it's also fitting to when like coffee hasn't kicked in yet. Help, answer this. But I'm going to go with, I do enjoy Help.
Emily Fox, what about you?
Something. That's my favorite song.
God, this is like the Who's On First of Beatles songs.
I literally just did a spit take. I have coffee all over my...
Oh my God. All right, Josh, what's left? What other vague Beatles songs are there for you to spit in my direction?
God. But I actually like the Beatles. I like All My Loving is my favorite. That's my favorite Beatles song personally.
And I love Blackbird personally. That means that I probably would have cooked a Blackbird, which I don't know if that's would have presented as edible, maybe a bit salty to the judges. So I'm sure we'll get into a bunch of musical opinions. I know Antonio Mazzaro in Abstentia has some very vivid opinions about the songs that the chefs chose to base their dishes off of. But we have a bit of a road trip to go on, ladies and gentlemen. We are making our way from a party boat into the party city of Nashville, Tennessee for a one-time only event in Top Chef Kentucky. Kurt, I know we were questioning this last week. Has any information been revealed? Do we know exactly why they did this in the middle of the season?
I think probably only because they weren't going to have the finale there. And I actually liked Antonio's reasoning. It's like, well, we're not going to have the finale there. And, you know, Kentuckians heading to Nashville for like a weekend trip is kind of part of what being a Kentuckian is all about. So let's fit it in. It's like they're close enough. It's not going to get its own season, most likely, at least in the near future. So we can't really do Kentucky without getting some of its neighbors in.
I could have sworn. I mean, this goes to show just like my bad brain for Top Chef. But I was like, haven't we done Top Chef Nashville? Has that not happened yet? Is that not a thing? And it's not a thing. So I live in the alternate universe where Top Chef Nashville has already taken place, I suppose. See,
I have the same memory buffer being wiped, whereas you start talking, I'm like, oh crap, was there an entire season that took place in Tennessee?
Yeah.
That just kind of deleted now?
Yeah. I don't know if you guys remember, we covered Top Chef Nashville.
Nope.
It was after our hit Berenstain Bears podcast.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We just did a post-show recap on Shazam starring Sinbad. Like that's
right.
I don't know how you guys don't remember it.
That's right. I forgot.
The Mandela quickfire effect.
Nelson won that season.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yes. Could not keep him apartheid from his.
Wow.
This is awful. Whoa. This is awful stuff.
We got to start over. We can't do this.
Yeah, start
over.
All right. Let's go back. Everyone remember your Beatles puns.
Norwegian wood. Norwegian fresh. Wood. That's my change dancer.
Is that the safe word for this podcast?
Oh boy.
No,
well,
help,
I know
help still is.
Josh and Emily, I know you both are well traveled. Have either of you had any experience in the great city of Nashville?
No.
We've never been to Nashville. We've talked about it lightly. We've talked about like road tripping to Nashville, but it's never happened for us.
So this is a dead end.
And I constantly get Nashville and Memphis confused. I've been to one of them.
Yeah, I had the exact same thing. And no offense to our Tennessean listeners out there. I got that mixed up as well. I've been to Memphis, but I haven't been to Nashville. Because I remember the Ducks walking through the hotel lobby is Memphis. I remember that.
Oh, okay. Then I've been to Memphis. Because is Graceland near Memphis or Nashville?
I think Graceland is Memphis.
Okay, then I've been to Memphis because I was right near the Mississippi border. It was for work. We had long story.
Antonio
short.
Mazzaro rolling in his bed as he is listening to us butcher the South.
Exactly. Yes. Well, look, we had to travel away from Kentucky, and I guess our Kentuckian resident included as we make our way to a city that none of us have been in. Apparently, Justin has been in. many, many times. He seems to be like the biggest Nashville head in the cast here. We're not going to see too much of Nashville, admittedly. We're going to see some very key sites and key concepts involved in Nashville. And our first stop here is the Grand Ole Opry. But first, as everyone is driving in their cars and Eddie, I mean, look, the challenge pretty much wiped them out. So I think it's understandable that these chefs sleep. But poor Eddie. Josh, we were talking about this before the podcast. I mean, it's a little unfortunate that while Adrian is puking on the side of the road, poor Eddie is just completely aloof and asleep. Snoozing through it all.
Two chef testings who just like have their mouths like completely agape, out of their minds with either fatigue or with vomit. It would appear in the case of Adrian, one dead sick, one dead tired. It's a real shame. But I mean, that boat challenge, you can imagine really wiping these guys pretty severely before they head out to Nashville.
Yes, swabbed their moods just like swabbing the deck. Emily, I'll admit, I was a little surprised. I had sort of put the pin on Adrian last week and said, like, okay, looks like she was doing well. She said she was feeling better. As soon as she hit land, it turned out to not be the case. This will sort of be something that tracks Adrian throughout the episode. Were you surprised to see her illness return story-wise, and did that make you worried for her throughout this episode?
I mean, it did and it didn't. I think probably the turnaround time from one challenge to the next leaves very little time for anyone to recover, especially given how that challenge went. I felt so bad for her. Like, I know what that feels like to be like, you need to pull over real quick. you know, she really, it looked like she was slowly recovering in this episode, which is good. But my heart went out to her because there's nothing worse than having some sort of illness and being like, I still have to get up and do this. So
do we know what exactly she has yet? I don't know. I don't know how prolific she's been on social media, but do we have any guesses as to, like, I don't know. It seems like nothing's been diagnosed. So again, it doesn't make me feel like she's going to be removed for sickness or anything, but it's odd that it seems to be lingering. Maybe to your point, Emily, the fatigue from the previous challenge didn't necessarily help.
Yeah. And I bet you it's just like some sort of bug or virus or something. It happens.
Yeah. I just hope that doesn't spread to the rest of the chef.
I know. That's what I kept thinking. I'd be like, I would not want to be in the backseat of that car with her. Nope.
Not to be mean, but I kind of do hope it spreads to the rest of the chefs, because I think that would be fascinating television. It's just like every single one of the chef testants is just sidelined with disease.
Wow.
I think I'm married to this man.
Wow.
Like a 24-hour stomach bug quickfire. That would be great.
Quickfire challenge. We've introduced the influenza virus into the coffee you were drinking this morning. Make us the breakfast.
You know, we're so many seasons into Top Chef that anything they can do to shake it up, I'm here for.
I think if Contagion 2 ever came out, that would be a good marketing tie-in.
I don't actually want these people to be sick. I'm just being weird.
But it seems like, you know, it's on that chance that it is something contagious, the last thing that you want to be doing is like sitting in the back seat with like your mouth wide open. So I feel I'm surprised Eddie did not get sick and contract something during the course of this episode.
Well, maybe it's gestating right now. We don't know.
Did you guys know that the BMW is actually retrofitted with Purell dispensers in every seat?
Nice. Smart.
Oh, that
very
happens
smart.
When the trunk automatically.
Yeah, exactly.
So it just squirts out a nice spurt of Purell. Also,
for something so clean, that just sounded very dirty.
Also, I'm pretty sure if Eddie got sick, you wouldn't be able to tell just by the look on his face.
Yeah, he's still shitting bricks even on his healthiest day.
Oh, boy. So everyone travels 150 miles to Nashville, and one person is pumped out of this world to go to the Grand Ole Opry. Kelsey is a huge country music fan. She's watched over 50,000 videos on the Grand Ole Opry stage. She's the one who, nicely enough, gets to fawn over Hunter Hayes in this quick fire challenge. Anybody here a big country music fan? Am I going to get a similar response here as to when I asked
yes.
you?
Yes.
I was waiting. I was like waiting with bated breath for you to go. So, you know, Josh, Emily, what's your favorite rising country music star?
I feel like
it's now Hunter Hayes because he's the only one I know about.
Shania
Other
Twain.
Than Chase Rice, I guess.
She's rising. She's been rising for the past, you know, 30 years or so. I'm sort of like a country music fan by proxy. My sister has become a huge country music fan. So every time, like, I see a country music star, like, on this show or on, like, back when there was a task on The Apprentice where they had to make a country music star, I have to like reach out to her. I'm like, okay, who's Hunter Hayes? Like, give me like the 411 on him. But he seems pretty, you know, he seems like he's made a good name for himself. I believe when Padma announces him at the end, he's a multi-hyphenate, right? He's like a Grammy nominee, multi-platinum artist, and he seems totally amicable here. It's tough comparing him to Lena Waithe, who seemed like she was totally into the food aspect of it all. It seemed like he was most concentrated on people watching him eat, which I didn't really think about it, but I guess it's kind of a weird thing, right? To think about millions of people watching you eat.
Yeah, I think that's strange. I mean, I understand it, though, myself. In, like, a restaurant, if I detect that somebody is watching me eat a plate of food, I feel deeply uncomfortable.
Sorry, and I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, it really is typically you. Like, I'll look up, and, like, you're just staring at me. I'm like, Emily, please stop just staring at me right now. Let me enjoy my meal.
This is 100% true, by the way. This is not a fake, like, thing.
That's not a bit.
Is it? Hey, Mike, is it true that at Club 96, you have to eat back to back? So this would be a good cure for Josh?
Yes, absolutely. And then you have to whisper the reviews to the to your partner. Yeah. I'm intrigued. Emily, is there any particular reason why you look at your partner while he's eating? Is it just that you're intrigued by what he's going to feel about the food?
I'm really glad that Mike is asking the hard questions on this podcast this week. I'm very curious for the answer, Emily. Think carefully.
The reality is I like to see how you eat and which things you're mixing together. And also, I enjoy your company so much that I can't take my eyes off of you.
Note that she said she liked you as a subject before she mentioned that she liked you as a husband.
I noted it. I'm going to give that answer an F.
Wow. But, tough grainer.
Wow. There's no kernel.
No. What else do you guys want to know?
Yeah, this is an AMA baked. This is like a shakshuka. You guys are the eggs and we're the tomatoes around.
Oh, can I not be the egg?
In Nashville.
But I see the point of like having, like, especially you have a chef who's made you a dish and then puts it in front of you and is standing there watching you eat it, looking for any sort of reaction. It's different than someone like sitting across the table from you, like kind of idly studying you. So I kind of see what he was saying.
I also have to say, for somebody who doesn't feel comfortable getting watched while he eats, I had a blast watching Hunter Hayes eat.
You really did.
I thought that he was hilarious. So he has, when Padma's like, what did you think of the chef's efforts? Like, he has like no hesitation. He just goes, phenomenal. It was delicious. Like, he had the best time ever. And you could just tell that he was having a blast. And I really enjoyed watching Hunter Hayes eat. I know nothing about his music, but I am now a fan of watching this man eat food. And I hope that he turns this into a secondary career.
All right.
Eating. Oh,
wow. Yes, just like eating on camera, like the way that like people unwrap packages on YouTube. I just want Hunter Hayes to eat a plate of food in front of a camera, and I want to watch that live feed.
What's up, YouTube? It's your boy, Hunter Hayes. Today, I got some deviled eggs in front of me. I'm just going to chomp on it for you, see how you react, like, and subscribe.
Except I feel like it's just going to be like raw red meat every time. Yeah. Like, apparently, like, Hunter Hayes is just a big fan of raw red meat. Doesn't matter what else is put in front of him. Any slab of raw steak is just going to be the thing.
It was rare. It wasn't raw.
It looked pretty rare.
Well, let's get into the challenge because basically they're saying these chefs are basically going to serve as for a hot second as on the road cooks for Hunter Hayes. And I guess by proxy is his entourage as well. They've been given a rider of foods that Hunter likes to eat. And they're either going to make a breakfast, lunch or dinner based on the information in there. Kurt, in general, what'd you think about this quickfire?
I thought it was interesting. I liked the concept, except that the only thing that got me is that when you think of a rider, you usually think of like meals and complete foods versus ingredients.
Mm-hmm. I know that you two are both big fans of Hunter Hayes. What'd you think about the quickfire itself involving Hunter Hayes?
I mean, I think, I don't know. I'm used to, I used to like be in charge of like disseminating information with writers. So it was funny to like kind of see that reimagined and on the screen. And I really wanted there to be like one thing where it was like only blue M&Ms, because that's like the classic writer, you know, joke. I forget what band used to do that, but yeah, it was kind of fun to.
Why only blue M&Ms? Why
was that a thing? That you read the writer.
Yeah,
because that used to be cool.
it was like something baked in there of like, hey, if you've actually read through every detail, then you know that only put green M&Ms in the
dressing. Yeah, because that used to be a really big issue, and it still is, depending on who the act is. Like, if you're not really like a big, you know, like superstar, some people are just like, eh, we got you a plate of cold cuts, and you're like, that's actually not on the rider. But yeah, it was a way to sort of get people to really pay attention, and you could catch someone pretty quickly if you're like, okay, you didn't read this at all. So anyway, I thought that was really fun, although I felt like it probably was getting, I don't know, you kind of get the shaft if you get the breakfast rider. I sort of feel like that's just okay. I don't know.
Yeah, so
David, I did like how David took all the eggs. He gave a couple.
I know, that was crazy.
And like gave none to Eric, which actually ended up helping him.
Yeah, exactly.
Because neither of the egg dishes did great.
Yeah, the eggs ended up being a curse there. Leah, let's talk a bit about this breakfast here, because there are a few interesting things in here. I want to start with Kelsey, her shakshuka, because as soon as I heard deconstructed pizza, I knew I had to throw a question to Josh Wegler here. What is your thought about the shakshuka?
You know what? It's interesting, because those are flavors that I really love. Obviously, I love anything tomato sauce is something that's going to rise to the top of my must eat list. Clearly, I am known as somebody who enjoys a slice of pizza every now and then. but the shakshuka thing has always kind of weirded me out. It's just not something that I would really go for. I'm not super keen on eggs anymore, since, you know, Emily and I, we don't really eat we don't eat a lot of like super breakfasty breakfast foods because of Emily's egg allergy, and out of solidarity I tend to shy away from eggs, and over the years that solidarity has turned into I actually just don't really like eggs that much anyway. So I feel like shakshuka for me, even though it is like 90% stuff that I like, there's just like there's the weird component of just like eggs being baked into tomato sauce. It just doesn't
but
work
like,
for me.
But like, here's the thing. Didn't she just like do like a soft boil on them? Like, that's not even how you make shakshuka. Like, you put shakshuka directly into the tomato sauce and let it cook with the tomato sauce, and then you serve it. You like kind of scoop it out and put it on your plate. Like, you crack the egg first raw into the tomato sauce. Like, you make a little hole for it. So I was like, this isn't even really the traditional way of doing it from what my take has been for shakshuka. Did you guys agree with that? Or
yeah, it was a little weird to see, because usually you see like, I don't know, it looks more like a sunny side up.
Right, you know? Right.
And this more looks like, hey, I like soft boiled an egg and just plopped it in some tomato sauce and gave it to you.
Yeah, I was like very confused by that. So,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I at first thought that shakshuka was that place in Midtown West that's really crowded all the time right next to Port Authority, but apparently that's Shake Shack. So I think I'm just Kurt, what did you think about David's take on the omelet? Because I feel like, slowly but surely, omelets have been emerging on Top Chef as like something deceptively simple. We saw Natalie and LCK early on in this season be able to perfect one. It's clear it misses here. What did you think about particularly David's technique for a perfect omelet?
Well, it's funny that like I think that Hunter Hayes in his comments said that it was like nice and light, but David still ended up being in the bottom three. So maybe it wasn't so nice and light. I don't know. It's like, the ingredients that he put in there, I really like. You know, let's add this to the underreported list. I really love jicama.
But Kurt, we definitely don't talk enough about how much you like jicama.
We definitely don't. It's and again, now we've talked about just the right amount. But the prosciutto, the goat cheese vinaigrette was interesting. So I like out of all of the breakfast options, I actually would have wanted to try David's omelet the most. And so I was actually, based on Hunter Hayes's, if that's the correct possessive use of the word, based on his assessment of it being nice and light, I was surprised to see it at the bottom.
Yeah, the prosciutto salad's interesting to me, because I guess it's sort of like a take on like eggs and insert meat here. So it's sort of, I guess it's sort of like bridging it from breakfast into lunch. I guess the comments were that they felt that goat cheese vinaigrette was overwhelming and they actually wanted more egg. So maybe even though it was light, they didn't really get the eggs out of it. And this will not be the last time that David will earn some consternation here.
Yeah. And I'm a big, like I said, I'm like, and on that scale, I would much rather have the goat cheese than the egg, so I wouldn't have minded that.
I'm actually intrigued that you guys had said that, you know, the breakfast one might have been the short end of the stick, because I feel like the lunch options were kind of boring, considering that they all fixated on the word salad, it seems, and just all made salads. I know that Sarah's going to get the commendations here for the cauliflower salad, because it's done two ways, but I don't know, maybe the little kid in me would want to go for the grilled cheese salad, Emily, that Michelle was making.
I loved that. I was like, ooh, I got to try that. That's a really good idea. I don't know.
And Hunter Hayes having the palate of a little kid, you would think would also have gone for that.
No, I think it makes me think of like, I don't know, if they didn't know who they're going to be serving, they're probably like, oh, let's make it light. Not to like, you know, genderize this, but like make it a little bit lighter and like a little bit fresher, which, you know, does tend to be the right move, I think, for lunch in general, at least for me. But,
Totally.
You're going to eat later right after you perform. So it makes sense to keep things light. But I love the grilled cheese. I think that's such a brilliant move.
Yeah. And then, of course, for dinner, again, I think Justin and Adrian both fixated on the red meat, as according to you, Josh, as apparently Hunter does as well. And Adrian going to pull off the surprise win here with a seared filet mignon with a Cajun spice corn, a roasted pepper puree, and fennel salad. Kurt, I should have told you to cover your ears. I'm sorry. We'll throw some jicama in there to maybe
or some of Sarah's blackberries, because we know that the BY like this.
But it's so interesting to me, because this whole edit is like Adrian basically being like, look, I'm not feeling well. I can do corn, I can do pepper, I can do steak. And it turns out that the simplest dish was the one that won it. Josh, what did you make of the way this quickfire was portrayed in Adrian specifically?
Very strange, very odd. It's like she's even talking about how like she's really lazily putting this stuff together and she's just trying to survive. And then Hunter Hayes loses his mind for it. Like he's just like obsessed. And like you can tell instantly that he is just like head over heels with what Adrian has created. And so it raises some questions to mind. Is this a judgment on Hunter Hayes' palate? Is this like an indictment? Of Hunter Hayes? Does he like disease as his secret ingredient? Or for Adrian, is Adrian like, does she cook at her best when she's underestimating herself? Maybe even like if she's just kind of like relaxed is the wrong way to describe it, because obviously she was not feeling well, so she was really just trying to make it through, but she wasn't probably thinking about it terribly hard at the same time. Maybe that's sort of something that she should be leaning on a little bit more. It's just like kind of going through, not going through the motions, but maybe just like approaching it a little bit easier. Like she seemed like she didn't put too much pressure on herself through this. She just like went for something like, yeah, I know I could just do this and it'll be fine. Maybe what she thinks is going to end up being fine is actually going to end up being really, really tasty.
Yeah, Kurt, what did you make of the final product that Adrian ended up putting out here?
Fennel.
That's you couldn't get past that at all?
No. I was actually more interested in Justin's dish. I think between the crispy, like the sides. I think to me, like the skirt steak salad and the seared filet mignon are kind of on par. I'm not just a huge kind of, you know, red meat person, so it was really came down to the sides for me, and the crumbly mushrooms and the crispy potatoes and the spinach. Like I was more intrigued by Justin's, but again, you know, I'm not, you know, they're tasting it and judging it based on the taste. So I'm going to have to trust the judges and Hunter that Adrian's was top notch.
Yeah, Emily, what do we make of this in terms of Adrian's chances? We've talked numerous times about how this field is really open wide this season. Do we feel like the fact that Adrian was able to win a challenge on her deathbed basically speak well to her chances of when she's actually cooking at full health in terms of future competitions?
I think she's really strong right now, despite the health consequences. So I'm kind of excited to see where she goes with this. You know, I mean, we'll see, you know, obviously we'll talk more as we move through the episode, but I'm feeling pretty positive about her altogether.
And we should also note here, Antonio made an effort to tell us that Padma was sporting a mullet on the Grand Ole Opry stage, I suppose, when in Rome. Again, no offense to our Tennessean listeners out there. I know Haley Strong, who is also absent from the podcast today, wanted me to talk about just how fantastic Padma's denim look was in this episode.
I did take note on the Canadian tuxedo.
Yes.
Yeah, we finally got we got accusations of it last episode, but I think we finally confirmed one this episode.
Yep, spotted.
So let's move into our elimination challenge here. And I talked about this a bit last week, but it got confirmed here. This is our new touchstone of Top Chef, which is basically cook a dish around a memory. This one is about, since Nashville is a city really based in music, music is baked into it like eggs in a shakshuka cooked by our beleaguered ex-boyfriend. Basically, they're going to create a dish inspired by a music memory. Now, Emily, I don't believe we've had you on the podcast when these types of challenges have come up. What do you think about them in terms of not only the cookery that comes out of it, but it's serving as a way for us to get to know the chefs as well?
I usually love a storyline like this, and I think a lot of people really did grasp it and go with it in a way that was really positive and made a lot of sense, depending on what song they chose. Although there are, huge missteps too, where someone's like, oh, I chose this, and you're like, oh, that did not translate. So I think it's always fun to kind of see what people pick. Like, the moment Eric was like, oh yeah, Big Papa, I was like, yes, yes, I love this. I love the cheese, eggs, and Welch's grape. Like, do this. So that was really awesome.
Yeah, Josh, I know when we checked in with you a couple of weeks ago, you had said that this cast wasn't necessarily, glomming onto you
right
at the moment. Do you feel like these types of challenges help sort of fill in the blanks for you to get to know these people?
Yeah, I wish it happened earlier in the season, because, and not to like shade it, like I really do mean it, that I think that structurally the structure of the season has really been, probably when I think about it, that's probably been the biggest issue for me, is that, these are the types of challenges I feel like you get relatively early. And the benefits of getting a challenge like this early is you get a story like Michelle's, and now like you're so hooked into Michelle as a character. And I think it's nice to get this bit of information of background of like what has happened in their lives, who have they lost, how did they gain the people that are important to them. It can still have impact, sort of mid-season. I think that it's helping me to feel more attached to the remaining players. There's only 6-7 contestants left after this episode, whereas if we could have gotten this earlier in the season, I think it really would have individualized people a lot better. That's why I like a challenge like this early, and a challenge like Restaurant Wars deep into the season, because if you give them that base of character background early on, then when they're really in the shit in the middle of Restaurant Wars, and you know that like somebody is just going to pop in, it's very likely either someone that you like a lot or somebody who you have grown to have passionate feelings about, you're so much more invested then. So I wish that we had a challenge like this earlier in the season. But as a rule, I like the challenges like this. I think the challenges like this really do reveal a lot about the chefs.
It is interesting that you bring up, this in Restaurant Wars, considering that this takes place at Eight Chefs, the point where Restaurant Wars would usually take place.
Yeah.
So they basically did like a flipper here. And yeah, I mean, I think even last season, I think the challenge in like episode 4 or 5 where Tyler went home was the cook to your family's heritage challenge. And I agree. I think no matter what you're exploring, when these chefs have to delve into their personal backgrounds, I think it strips away any head games that might go on in terms of like, oh, I have to cook this way for the judges, because it really makes people pull back to their personal roots. And, I think Tom said it a couple of weeks ago when he says, cooking you is when you're cooking at your strongest. And this is a way to inherently do so. Even to Emily's point, if some of them end up being more misses than hits. So speaking of hits, let's talk about some of these songs that these chefs end up picking, because I know Antonio Mazzaro has some thoughts. So here's what I'm going to do. I'll throw out a chef and the song that they pick. And if any of us have any thoughts about the song, speak now or forever hold your peace.
So fantastic.
Let's start with the ill Adrian, who picks Home by Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros. Any thoughts about that?
Alabama, Arkansas. That's the song. That's how it goes.
I like that song.
We like that song. We like that song in the Wiggler Fox household. We are unified on this front.
Yeah, I agree. I know there are a million songs named Home, this is probably in my top three. Would you get to
see the is the other one by Daughtry?
No, I would say the Philip Phillips one might be one of my favorites, or the Michael Bublé one. Again, there's yes. some freaking songs named Home. There's from one from The Wiz that's pretty damn good.
Shout out to Moonrock Paul Koch, who is the provider of the music for this season of First One Out. The final song you hear in the final episode of First One Out this season is also called Home.
Oh,
good cross promotion.
How about that?
Do you think maybe one day we can get all the Wandoff people to compete in a Top Chef competition and one of the challenges has to be create a dish based on a music parody?
Oh my God. I mean, I wish if the Wandoff is ever so successful that we're getting food competitions out of it. I'll get the Wombat's apron ready. You know, that's an easy sell.
Now, Kurt, you do have to detect if people from the same location are putting out multiple dishes at the same time.
I'm looking forward to the Cherry Hill dessert, Kurt.
Yo, yes, very much so. I'll get on that. We can definitely make sure that there's not more than one fennel based dish in the group.
All right. Next up, David is invoking his time in Portugal by going, basically picking an entire album, Incubus's Morning View. Antonio so eloquently wrote in his notes, thumbs up my butt. I don't know what that means, if that's like a thumbs up, but I don't necessarily like it. I'm trying to figure it out. But what do we all think about Incubus and or the Morning album, if we have any sort of opinions on it?
You know, right around that time that album came out, I remember going into New York City from Long Island, where I grew up, with a bunch of friends and seeing Incubus at Madison Square Garden and having the time of my life. And I was a young lad back in those days who did not have the most discerning musical palate. I don't know the last time that I put on Incubus, but in that stretch of time, I really enjoyed them. So if it were me and I was making a dish with Incubus as like the fuel of my memory, I'd probably be putting forth like a Madison Square Garden hot dog. So it's probably for the best that I'm not the one. I probably, like David, would be removed from the competition.
I probably would have thought, I think maybe my Incubus, I'm not a huge Incubus fan, but I think my favorite song is Dig. And maybe you could do something with like,
oh yeah, I forgot about that song.
Like, that's what I love about this too, is like our own interpretations of these. So next,
they have a song called The Warmth, and one of the lines is experience the warmth. So you could like say that as you're lifting a lid off of a piping hot plate. That would have been cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Next up here, Eddie choosing his wedding song, Love You Madly by Cake. Kurt, are you as high on Cake as you are Cake the dessert?
I love Cake. Actually, I enjoy many of Fashion Nugget, I think was the first Cake album that I had bought. Here you had, you know, Eddie going back to a song that was important to him because it was, you know, his wedding song, and then so that also then brought him back to the time like one of the first dishes that he made for his wife. I liked the story about how his wife didn't like fish, and so he made her fish.
Yeah, Eddie essentially was like the change my mind guy of like, all right, I'm gonna make you like fish. And also his choice made me think of like, I mean, my first dance wedding song was Gold from the movie Once. So I don't know, it could have been like, if I found myself on Top Chef for some reason, there's something in there with like golden potatoes and other golden foods. I don't want to play too much marriage counselor again to you, Emily and Josh, but what was your wedding song? Would you be
ours
to
was out of it? Kiss from a Rose, so it was a grilled seal.
No!
Yeah, we really hammed that one up.
Yeah,
or build a graying tower out of something.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, I think I would pick Ironic as my song by Alanis Morissette, and then I'd have like a chicken breast and then like a poached egg or something on the side, because that's my life. I grew up with chickens and then ended up allergic to eggs.
And then you just sprinkle some rain on there.
Yeah, exactly.
But not.
I would pick a song by Fish and serve fish.
Well, that was really like, you're speaking on the level of Caleb Folliwell, the lead singer of Kings of Leon, who served as our guest judge this episode. I actually was I'm not as big of a Kings of Leon fan as Justin, but I enjoy their music. But I was actually a big fan of him as a guest judge, just sort of like you were saying before about Hunter Hayes, his sort of enigmatic enthusiasm. I feel like Caleb Folliwell was having a very fun time granted, I don't think he really had much input in terms of the dishes, but I think when it came to like providing commentary and puns, he was
funny.
Yeah, he was hitting 100% in my opinion.
Yeah, he was good.
I think someone forgot to tell his wife Lily that no, you provide the feedback after they leave the table. Like she would eat it, like take a bite while the chef testants were still there. And she'd say, "Oh, this is what I think. And it's like, no, we'll discuss it once you leave. Don't talk while the kids are in the room.
And
she was very excited, but she was very enthusiastic, I think is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Just like Caleb.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody take a quick break here? Anybody Kings of Leon fans from a major perspective? Obviously, again, not on the Justin level of the hipster-esque. I was, following Kings of Leon before they became cool, but anybody big fans of you, somebody?
No.
No. No.
Can we talk about that guy at the end of the table, though, that had like a beautiful like Hawaiian shirt on and a mustache and was balding? Who was that guy?
Oh, yeah. He sort of looked like, I don't know, like a... God, I was going to say like a skinny David Crosby.
Like Gallagher?
Like, I don't know. Yeah, he kind of looked like him.
I love Gallagher. Gallagher Watermelon Challenge, where are you?
Oh, boy. I think it was, his name is Tandy Wilson, which I feel like describes him personally. Like, if you told me, draw someone named Tandy Wilson, it might have been that guy, word for word.
He seemed like a nice enough guy. I was just like, I want to know more about this guy.
Yeah, because he was the only one that didn't really have a huge, like, role. Like, he wasn't one of the people who was name-checked as a judge at the beginning. He wasn't, Sean Brock, who wanted to poach, not egg-related, wanted to steal Michelle to work at his restaurant. So he didn't really get much of a biographical.
Well, I think he should right now. I want to just say that Tandy, wherever you are, excellent, excellent work.
Yeah, he seemed he geeked out when Tom said this is the best dish of the season. And he's like, I wanted to be there when you said that.
Loved it.
All right, let's get back to the songs here. We're going old school with Kelsey. Kelsey does A Sunday Kind of Love by the late, great Etta James. She, as Antonio points out in his notes here, it is a little interesting that she dedicated a quick fire dish to her ex-boyfriend and a song to her husband. Maybe that's why the disconnect happens that puts her in the bottom here. But I love this song. I think it's just such a sweet song.
Can you sing a little bit of it for us, Mike?
I'm in a Sunday kind of love, a love to last past Saturday night. I know like the Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons version, but it's not like the easy like Sunday morning easy listening. It's more of that that old school Jersey jazz.
Oh my God, that was wonderful.
Oh, wait. I'll be a guest judge in the Wand Off Quickfire. All right, moving on here. Sarah does an ode to her dad, Jambalaya by Hank Williams. Any thoughts here on Sarah's choice of song and or dish?
I don't know this song, but it sounds like I should. Antonio's notes say thumbs way up. We don't know where the thumbs are going, but but thumbs way up. That sounds good.
Hopefully past the butt.
Yeah, this thumbs up the small intestine. That's how much he likes it.
I was going to say just like avoid the butt altogether, but...
Well, I mean, yeah, that can be interpreted in many ways, I guess.
Kurt, any thoughts about Jambalaya, the dish, or the song?
See, I liked the route that Justin took, I think, a little bit more in terms of the song interpretation. But, it's one of her memories. I love Creole food, and whether it's jambalaya or gumbo or a nice etouffee, I was all over, like, the... what was being made. It was just looking forward to seeing how this was going to turn out from a dish, at least.
All right. Let's turn to what I think is going to be the main point of conversation with these seven songs. Eric channeling the notorious B.I.G., Big Papa. I thought this was super interesting because, Kurt, I think you talked about the levels of ways that people were interpreting the songs, but Eric got so granular as to actually take a snatch of lyrics and make food from it. What did you all think about the decision that Eric made there, both in choice of song and in choice of dish?
Excellent song, excellent dish. Josh, what did you think about it?
I love it when you call me Big Papa. Oh, wow. And I love it when Eric makes a dish inspired by the notorious B.I.G. I'm a B.I.G. fan of that choice.
have you been to the street that apparently Tom hung out on as well?
St. James Place. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's where Tom lives. Okay, now I'll just go casually walk around there.
Yeah, and at first you had her Dale's apartment tag.
Yeah.
Now you have Tom's location.
Yeah, and I know where Padma lives already. So, I mean, listen, guys, we got this.
I think if you guys go Christmas caroling next holiday season, you know what stops to me. All right, well, let's talk about Justin's take on Purple Rain here. For some reason, this reminded me of back in season 4, there was this improv challenge where they had to take like three random words that audiences suggested and put them into a dish. And this seems like something out of there where Justin takes this interpretation where he essentially does everything color based. You know, obviously he's going back to the Minnesotan background, but he's doing, you know, this gnocchi, braised red cabbage, some port wine, braised meat. Like he is going all out here. Kurt, I know that you said you felt like Sarah's was a bit too on the nose. Did you not feel like Justin's was too?
No, because like Purple Rain isn't a food, whereas jambalaya is. I think that's all I meant by that. I liked the idea of taking like a song title and creating a dish inspired by it. Again, only because that's probably the route I would have initially wanted to go. And like you, it's really, really strange. We talked earlier about I usually kind of completely mentally wipe out past seasons from my brain. But I remember I was thinking about the improv challenge, and I'm surprised that it was all the way back in season 4. The fact that I still remember it, maybe it's just because of the improv classes I've taken, and just like wedged in my brain. But that this also his approach very much reminded me of that. Like you're given a song title. Create some dishes or a dish inspired off of that. So I think I kind of liked Tom building on that a little bit, his little yes and to, okay, you're going with a Prince song, maybe throw in some raspberries in there, which I might have gone overboard and done.
It is underreported how much you like raspberries as well.
Actually, that was my breakfast before the podcast. I had my breakfast was coffee and raspberries. I just thought it was a fun approach, and was curious how it was going to turn
out. I'm disappointed he didn't pick Little Red Corvette. I feel like that would have been a much more interesting dish, but
I made a car.
little Red Corvette.
Ooh. Yes, that would have been great.
A chili, like a red chili aioli or something.
Or like, I don't know, I took 1999 ingredients and put it into one dish. And now you have to technically
Getsuji.
Getsuji, yes.
Yeah. And finally, I mean, it's interesting that you said you could throw in some raspberries in because Michelle decides to go super, super vague and just do all of the Beatles, and this is really, in my opinion, the most heart-wrenching story of them all. I mean, we get these, you know, once every season here, but with Michelle, she talks about how the Beatles to her callback of weekends working in the garden, with her parents, and she gives this tragic story about her father committing suicide 16 years ago, and it's always tough to evoke those tough memories on Top Chef. I think we see the negative side of it when Kwame, memorably a few years ago, cooked this dish that reminded him of his strained relationship with his father, which ended up putting him on the bottom. Michelle here is fantastically able to really turn these torrid emotions into passion that exudes itself in this dish, producing something that really hits like gangbusters. And I'm glad that this happened just because, I mean, of all the chefs, we knew nothing about Michelle. You could name maybe three things about Michelle going into this episode. And I'm so happy that she not only got the win here, but got some character development as well. Josh, what did you think about Michelle's story this episode?
Yeah, fully agreed. Like I think because we were like making lots of jokes earlier in the season, like I've been excited about Michelle all the way through, but now like I feel invested in Michelle. I feel like that was a real, like you said, a very heartbreaking story about what's happened to her in her life, but she was able to really honor her father and honor those memories. And the Kwame comparison is a really good one because that was an instance where he was really like weighted down by sort of the gravitas of everything that had gone on in his life and wasn't really able to shake that, where for Michelle, this really felt like kind of like an upswinging celebration of where she came from. And I think for a challenge like this, when it's so personal, if you're able to kind of, harness that alchemy of something that is really close to home for you and something that you feel with such intense sense memory and channel that into your cooking and create a dish that is going to be firing on those cylinders, it's going going to produce, as I believe it's Tom who says, or somebody else who says it, that this is the best dish that they've had all season, which kind of sucks the air out of the tension later on when they're doing the winner reveal of the challenge. Like, you kind of know at that point, like, oh, okay, so Michelle's going to win this. But that's just, it's an unstoppable combination. Like, there's just no one who's going to be able to rival that. And if Michelle can kind of take this momentum moving forward, she's going to be a dangerous person to watch going forward.
What do you think about that, Emily?
I mean, I just have to agree. And, you know, speaking more to the point you made earlier, it would have been nice to kind of know a little bit more about Michelle earlier in the season with an episode similar to this. You know, I think it's kind of falling later on. But I'm so glad to kind of like see her really champion this challenge and do so well. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where I'm like, how is this going to kind of come together? But it was a beautiful plate of food. And to see Sean Brock just be like, wow, I want to hire her. That was a really exciting moment. I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, before we get into the dishes, some of the drama that happens in the kitchen. I want to talk about the plight of poor David here, because he initially wants to, again, invoke these Portuguese flavors. He wants to go for octopus. It's frozen. And I think he notably, I think, makes a good choice here in being like, I'm not going to make frozen octopus for these judges. And instead he goes for this clam and pork pairing. And it really, it's like a roller coaster of moods here, where he's feeling good about it. Then the clams are super rubbery and he's very frustrated, like throwing things everywhere. We're channeling Justin in Restaurant Wars. Then he seems to be coming back around to it. Then his sauce over reduces. So, Kurt, what was your take on sort of the unfortunate circumstances that belied David over the course of his preparatory process here?
I think we've learned, and I can say this because they're not a sponsor of the podcast, is that if you are going to be shopping for your ingredients at Whole Foods and you plan on doing anything that remotely involves seafood, whether it was Sarah's lobster rolls from last week or it was David's need for octopus this week, you need to have a plan B and possibly a plan C, because Whole Foods might not have the ingredients you're looking for. So I think, you know, He did turn. It sounded like he had that plan B. I don't know if he kind of knew that going in. It seemed like he said that, you know, the clams were a bit larger than he had wanted and they were having a hard time opening up. I don't know. I felt bad, but it didn't seem like the plight with the sauce or the clams is what did him in. This seemed to be, apparently, there's a lot of salt in the air in Nashville, and it just kind of coalesces onto people's plates. But between the saltiness of his dish and the fact that a lot of the things were just kind of indistinguishable from each other, except for the potatoes, I think that did him in more than necessarily like the specific ingredient choices and the problems with getting the clams open or the sauce reduced.
Yeah, Josh, Emily, what do you think about that? I know I'm sort of jumping the gun a bit here, but considering how much trouble David went through in bringing the dish together, what do you think ultimately did him in?
I mean, I think it comes down to confidence, right? So he was really thrown off by not having the octopus available. And, you know, when you're trying to think plan B that quickly too, you know, they only have how many minutes in the grocery store to really get it done. You're going to pick something else. Okay, what else is Portuguese? Pork and clams, yes, right? But if you're not even getting the specific ingredients, like the type of clams you want, right? Those were so large. They were, you know, characteristically probably going to be a little chewy if you don't cook them correctly. That sets you off on a whole other tangent where you're just trying to survive. And I think you could see him kind of being manic in these certain moments where he's just like, this is not what I wanted to do. And that really sucks. Like, that's, there's nothing you can really say to make it better when you aren't really working with the ingredients that you want.
Clams are a scary backup choice too, I feel like, because there's so much that can go wrong there. Like, if you put like an unopened clam or an unopened any kind of like shellfish like that on a plate in front of me, certainly, like, I'm like, okay, don't eat that one, that makes me nervous. Like, I feel like just like for that to be the thing that you go through for like door number two if your initial plan isn't working, like, that's already, for me at least, just like a tightrope that you're walking. So it seemed scary for David all the way through.
Yeah, it's so interesting, though, because I feel like David has really been this like force of positivity throughout the competition. Yeah. Even last episode when Brian was being a grumpy Gus and was like, oh, my God, power's out. I was like, don't worry, we'll get through it. He even got through that disastrous restaurant wars with, you know, his mood intact. But here, I don't know. He seems to be coming apart at the seams. I don't know if it's just at this point in the competition. I don't know if it's just, you know, that exhaustion building up that we were talking about before. It seemed a bit uncharacteristic for me, or it seemed like a really big indicator of like David's really in trouble. If he, of all people, is freaking out about this, you know that he's not doing well. The other, I think, big piece that comes out of this this preparation stuff, even like last minute preparation stuff, is that Justin seems like he flat out forgets to make one more plate of food to present to the judges. I'm glad it still put him in the top. I'm glad that the judges still want to put him in the top to acknowledge that. But Josh, as a lifelong fan of this show, did you get bad feelings in your gut for Justin when you found out that he left one plate bare?
Yeah, it seems like he would probably be out of the running for the win at the very least. Like, I think that it's kind of an unforgivable sin. You know, like there were two people there who were like, oh, we'll share. You know, it's fine. But I think that the rules are rules, right? Like if you miss a dish, it's kind of hard to move past that. But for it to be like an automatic loss, I think would be an extreme reaction. And it was obviously a testament to the quality of the food that even though he wasn't eligible for the win, they still included him in that top three best dishes conversation, at which point he must have really been feeling like a horse's patoot that has Antonio's thumb in it.
Yeah, to your point, like I agree. I was like, oh man, maybe Justin would have won if he had put the other plate out there. But at the same time, like you said, so much praise was heaped onto Michelle's dish.
Exactly. Yeah,
she was the clear number one, and maybe Justin would have been number two had he gotten the dish out there. But otherwise, he was just sort of competing for the top. Kurt, did you?
I also wonder, just really quickly, like when they make a comment like and include it in the episode as well for Michelle's dish, that this is the best dish that we've had all season. Is there an argument to be made for like, don't even give us winner's circle, just like just let us know that Michelle is the best and just use this opportunity to like really heap praise upon how delicious this plate of food is.
Mm. So just sort of like yada yada through the actual like suspense.
Bust past the structure a little bit and just like give us a unique moment on Top Chef where it's like there's no need for the drama because there is none. This was the best dish for sure, and everyone is unified on that.
What do you think about that, Kurt?
Nah. No, I see what Josh is saying. I could do it once, maybe. But like, I would be more tempted to be like not include that sort of commentary in at the dining table where they're tasting, and to save it more for a judge's table when you're giving the feedback on why Michelle won. I do like the structure of the top three. Like unless it ends up being there's some drama or something like to fill up the rest of the I think we still kind of like I like the top three structure. I'm sorry, Josh.
No, not at all. I love you. I would never not. I think that the moment that they lay that line out there, though, yeah. It's like, okay, yes. So there's nothing that's gonna come in the way of this. So it's just like it's just another one of these weird moments this season for me, yeah. Where it's just kind of like, what are you guys doing? What's going on here? So if it's so, you know, decisively good that they have to say that at that point and have to include that at that point in the show to like have that kind of hyperbolic praise, I think at that point for me it's like do something unique with the reveal of the winner. But I think your point is the better one of like maybe don't include that line like right there. Like it's nice to know that this is the best dish of the season, but is that something you can't repeat at you know after the reveal? Maybe would have been a more appropriate time to include that.
And to be fair, then that would have taken away from our love of Tandy. He would not have been able to like
true. His line poor out there Tandy about, would not have so, been able to get his gratification.
I think we could sacrifice Tandy in this case.
His tiny pony.
You shut your mouth.
For the good, for the good of the land. For the good of the land.
You just don't like his small pone.
Behind. No, I love his small pone. You're probably the one who has less.
I forgot we're trying to make pone.
Oh, it's already a thing.
It's a thing. You better hop on this bandwagon, Kurt. You're running alongside it.
Grab your jicama. We're going.
is the pone train now a thing?
It's the pony express, Kurt.
Okay, the small pone express.
The pone express.
Oh boy. Well, let's get into these dishes. No matter how hairy they may have gotten, Emily, which one stood out to you as something that you would really enjoy and really helped invoke the memories that they were trying to speak towards?
I mean, I probably would have really liked to taste Sarah's
grouper and sassafras with bone sauce, just because like I am a big fan of Creole food as well, and I'm just very interested in what a bone sauce tastes like. But yeah, that, I mean, it looked really good, and it was such a small plate where you're like, okay, this has to be infused with like an insane amount of flavor, right? I probably would have also have been interested to try Purple Rain, so the New York strip, because I, you know, that's the kind of thing where your whole mouth must be purple after you eat it. And then of course Michelle's food looked amazing, so
yeah. What about you, Kurt?
Are you desirous of the purple mouth? Is that what you're saying? Like that's a pro?
No, I mean I don't know. I just feel like that would happen.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fish fan. I'm talking about the food, and I guess you could maybe talk about the jam band. I like jam, but
underreported.
What kind of berry jam do you like?
I had a raspberry blackberry.
Your favorite thing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, yeah, throw some jicama in there, and that's basically no. Kurt's last meal.
That's Kurt's jam.
No, I shit you not that I have like a jam shelf in my fridge. I will send you a photo after the.
I used to do so much food preservation in 4-H, Kurt. Like you would have died. I had
you guys
so
have a
much
lot
jam.
To catch up on.
Yeah, all raspberry, all blackberry, all made from scratch. You would have loved it.
So I would have leaned more into maybe like the steak, the new, either Justin's New York strip, because I also like beets. Eric's dish, and Kel, like, except for the reaction to it, actually, you know, I love a good pot pie.
Yeah, I was going to say the
so
same
thing.
I would
have tried Kelsey's dish as well.
Yeah, that would have been my choice. I love chicken pot pie. And if you're going to trot out a chicken pot pie on Top Chef, I think it's got to be really lights out, because it's comfort food. It's very basic. And if you're not going to just bring out a really rock star version of chicken pot pie, Top Chef's probably a little too prestige for it. And it's a bummer that it seemed like it was a bit of a fail.
Yeah, this is tough because this is something that, you know, Kelsey really did well last week when she really took Tom's advice of like, stop trying to elevate things that don't need to be elevated. And so she says, okay, chicken pot pie really reminds me of my husband, so I'm going to make it. But, and I will say, I think that the plating of it is really fun. I think, what did Kelsey call it? Like a fairy tale, I don't know, adventure. But I don't know. I think if you look at it, it doesn't necessarily look like chicken pot pie to me.
No, it looks like deconstructed or open-faced chicken pot pie. I guess an open-faced pie is just like a topless tart, which is also something different. But
a topless tart? That could go in so many different directions. I love that.
Yeah, Kurt, why wasn't topless tart your nickname in college?
guys,
I never
guys.
Because I would, come
yes.
on.
Yes.
Sorry.
Back on track.
Yeah, it didn't look very chicken pot pie-ish now that you think about it. And they said it was like really like the opening reaction to it is like, oh, this looks really, you know, pretty. And it was and then someone even said it was really yummy, I believe was the word that was used. But then they started to go, wait, this is salty. Wait, this is really salty. Wait, this is margarita rim salty. So it kind of really spiraled out of control the longer the plate sat in front of them.
Yeah, I don't know what that was. What the, I don't know. Do we think it was just sort of like a misjudgment of Kelsey to feel like she really needed to season everything? Because I can't remember for the life of me the last time a judge like ran their finger along the plate and found all those salt grains that symbolize it. It seemed like Kelsey just sort of threw some on last minute before bringing it to the judges.
It's in the air in Nashville, I'm telling you. It's just something that just coalesced on people's plates.
Yes, that great oceanside city of Nashville. Yeah. Has salt in the air. I don't know, Emily, what did you make here of this take on chicken pot pie?
It looked like a little wreath of chicken pot pie. I don't know. I like that she was creative and sort of how she plated it, but obviously, yeah, what are you doing with all that salt? I don't get it.
I do want to talk about Justin's Purple Rain, just because I do agree. It mm-hmm. looks, he really pulled off the color palette, and I'm a big fan of beets as well. And so this idea of what he like, he boiled the gnocchi in the beet juice, I believe, yeah. Which sounds like an Eastern European man's dream come true.
I was going to say, it sounds like a mystery novel. He boiled the gnocchi in the beet juice. Like, I like
and
that.
And he's not wrong. Like I've, when I was, still doing Blue Apron, every time you'd have like a beet dish, like my kitchen looked like a crime scene because there's just like red stains everywhere. So I, you know, it's the moment he said like that was going to be his technique, I'm like, you know what, it seems like it would work. I'm curious how this is going to turn out.
Yeah. I will say from the other perspective, another meat dish, I really liked Eric's idea. I will say I don't like the way it looks. I don't know. There's something weird about the cut of the ribeye steak that's on like the food porn version that just like, it doesn't really look appealing to me. And then it's just, you know, I think that the Concord grape jus obviously shows a lot of technique. He sort of described how he had to do it early on. But other than that, it's just, you know, steak, some eggs and cheese sauce on top of some greens. And so I feel like even though it came across well for the judges, with the exception of a couple of them saying there were some temperature differences, it didn't necessarily look as good to me as something like Purple Rain.
Yeah, agreed.
You get like, given that like one of my bucket list items is literally to be like a food judge on in some sort of like, you know, cooking competition, I would probably never ever get invited because the way something looks is never really turns me away. I mean, just check my Instagram feed. I had a chocolate bao dumpling last night, and it's just this little, it looks exactly like how you would expect something that's supposed to be kind of like a little mound of brown. I mean, it literally looks like there's like just a giant brown turd in my hand. That's what this chocolate, but you know what? This is really cool and I'm going to eat it. So like the way Eric's dish looked would not have turned me.
How was it?
It was actually really good. It was a chocolate banana bao. So it was actually this chocolate. It was a banana on the inside and chocolate on the outside, but it was really, really good.
Nice. Well, let's move past a little mound of brown. Talk about something that got
also my nick. Never mind. Nope. Never mind.
Topless tart. You're done. Let's talk about
mound of hot brown was the other week.
There we go. Yeah.
Let's talk about something that ended up getting someone the green here. I want to go back to what Emily was saying about Michelle's dish, because I mean, I love that she was trying to evoke a garden, but it looked so colorful and so fresh that I think she absolutely nailed this. She had the story to boot, and it seemed like it was cooked really well. Just everything sort of worked together. I mean, just this just looked like a beautiful plate of food, in my opinion.
Yeah, I wasn't. Reading this on the menu, I think this would have been the last thing out of the eight that I would have ordered, because I'm not a big citrus fan. Like I love oranges by themselves, but like anything that's like lemon, lime, or citrus flavored in terms of like a pasta dish or a fish dish or anything. And that, like, how can we have two fennel dishes winning in this episode? It, like, is beyond me. So obviously I'm just not going to be trying Michelle's dish. I'm sorry.
I like how you,
good story.
I like how you said you basically would try anything if you were on the show, but it seems like you have one weakness.
I would still try it if I was a judge. But at the moment that she described that it was like there was fennel in it, that's a big, you know, barrier to get me to give you a thumbs up on your dish.
Well, careful where the thumb goes. I would I would say for me that I agree with you, Curtin, that like this is probably not something that I would order at a restaurant, largely because I'm a monster and I just want like the really like highly caloric item is probably the thing that I'm going to lean toward. But it would also probably be the thing that if it was put in front of me, if I was, you know, kind of pushed into ordering it, I'd probably be very happy that I did. Like, it seems like the kind of thing that that does hit a lot of the flavor profiles that I really do enjoy. I actually really do like the citrusy fish combination, I think, is a really tasty treat. So I think I would have enjoyed this. I think I would have liked it. I don't think I would have ordered it. I think I would have really, really been happy to eat it if I had ultimately gotten it.
I am interested in what a fennel onion puree would actually turn out like. So I think that so you'll mash up the peas and the mashed potatoes, and then you'll mash up the fennel into the onion, and maybe I'll actually enjoy it.
Well, speaking of high calories, let's talk about Adrienne's dish here. This cornage that she ends up putting out here, because she does something as sort of an idyllic take on her time cooking in New England. And sort of like in the quickfire challenge, she's saying like she even admits in confessional, like, I probably didn't win. I just want to cook something to be safe. And I will say, well, I feel like the bottom three dishes were definitively the bottom three. Personally, based on the judges' comments, this seems like it finished fourth from the bottom. I don't know, Emily, how do you feel about it?
I mean, it looked fine. I think the Naj was a little overwhelming looking, and they were like, yeah, it's a little coagulated, so I don't know. So that kind of turned me off a little bit, but I'm actually interested to see where she used to work in Maine. I'm going to look this up.
Is Naj supposed to be that thick?
I know. It kind of looked like grits, and you're like, I don't know. I've never even heard of Naj
before.
I don't really know what it is.
Well, Naj was that part of Nicki Minaj who did the rap on Monster.
Is this the fishy Minaj?
Yes,
it was. Yes, this is where they talked about how do you not make fishy Minaj?
I also am not that familiar with Naj. I'm wondering, you know, the fact that she won the quick fire, she had an extra hour to cook. I actually liked that for her, just given her condition, how she was feeling. I'm wondering if that hour was just okay. I'm going to take this hour. I'm going to, you know, not speed up. And if she didn't have that extra hour, I wonder if, you know, how the dish would have turned out and if that would have put her in the bottom. I was glad that she had the extra hour to kind of be able to take things at her own speed and land safely in the middle.
Yeah, well, let's talk about someone who ends up in the bottom here. Poor Eddie. He's been on a bit of a downward spiral himself. He decides to make this, you know, snapper, and he decides to, instead of risotto, he's going to put out this puffed rice. I mean, little does he know that I forget who in Last Chance Kitchen this season actually does well with the puffed rice, but I feel like this is sort of breaking one of those Top Chef commandments of, like, don't use prepared or boxed things because they're not going to go over well. And I don't want to invoke an image here, but, like, I'm looking at the dish now, kind of looks like maggots infesting his snapper.
No.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, puffed rice is a cereal with some milk in the morning, and then you're going to go about your day. Sure, fine. But, you know, put that, like, straight from the cereal box onto your fish is a strange idea for a dish, especially on Top Chef. I feel like it's just not a great idea. And I think as soon as he was starting to get the feedback, you really just, like, saw, like, the classic Eddie Money moments of him being like, no, you're right.
I'm wondering if he's like, because the dish that he had made for his wife was risotto, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if, like, did he just steer away from risotto because he didn't think he could cook it in time, or because we've had plenty of bad risotto moments in the history of Top Chef. So I'm wondering just what that's, because it also seemed like at one point he almost described, like, he seemed to be talking as if he was just maybe not going to do a risotto or a puffed rice at all. And he did it. At the last moment, or decided to add it. So I'm just kind of curious what the thinking behind the decision was, and why he chose not to do a risotto.
Yeah, it's weird because, like, I feel like there are other alternative staples you can use besides a box of puffed rice.
Yeah.
It seemed like he picked it out at Whole Foods, and maybe it was just a thing where time was ticking down, like we were talking about with David, but I don't know. It's an odd way to pivot. Emily, what did you think about Eddie's final product?
I mean, for me, I probably would have stayed away from a risotto, too, because it's just such a hard thing to time in terms of, you know, once you get it on the dish, is it going to still be a little bit al dente? You know, you get it up to the judges, are they going to be like, oh, it's not warm enough, or, like, you know, it's a little overcooked. It's, you know, it requires some finesse, and I don't know if he felt confident enough, you know, in this particular setting to do it. But why not make, like, a crispy rice? You can make that, you know what I mean? Like, why not do, like, I don't know, the best rice pilaf that anyone's ever had and do that? You know, it just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, obviously it's about executing what you think the flavors would be based on the challenge and what you remember from serving your wife this dish. But there are other rice alternatives if you were going to do rice at all. Or if you don't think that rice or risotto are your moves, then just don't do it.
Mm. Well, let's talk about the final dish that ends up in the bottom three here. It ends up being the eliminated dish, David's take on pork and clam. So, Kurt, you alluded to this earlier that I think the main criticism was A, too salty, and B, this will come over into Last Chance Kitchen. Tom really had no idea what he was eating, which actually mirrors really nicely. I don't know if you guys remember back to the first elimination challenge where David made that soup and he ended up in the top. Tom said, I don't know what I'm eating, but it's delicious. And now Tom says, I don't know what I'm eating, and I don't like that. Can you explain a bit more, Kurt, as to just the general criticisms that happened with David this year and whether or not you agree?
Yeah, you know, and regarding kind of, you know, Tom's commentary, like, I can see that being forgivable and being okay for a soup. You know, a soup is a mystery in a bowl, as nobody has ever said.
And, but you just did.
I just did.
Somebody slapped on an inspirational poster this minute and start selling it.
And but I kind of see like that being kind of a sentiment that is okay for a soup, whereas if you get a dish like this, you kind of want to be able to know what all the different ingredients are. And again, you have the over saltiness of it. And maybe my interpretation of Tom's critique is being heavily colored by the challenge that we end up seeing in Last Chance Kitchen. But ultimately I was a little bit, when we have Eddie and David and Kelsey on the bottom, I was pretty sure. Well, I guess even the margarita rim on Kelsey's plate made me question. I didn't know who was going to be going home. Like, to me, it actually was a toss up. Any of the three. So I'm not surprised that David went home. But in the same way, I could have easily seen anybody else going. But you know, but they had really nice things to say about his potatoes. But other than that, you couldn't tell what was what.
Yeah, Josh, what did you make of the pork and clams?
Yeah, I don't think I would be thrilled to eat it.
Yeah, you know, the pork itself kind of looks a little unappetizing, just sort of like sitting there by itself. The plating is a little weird here, at least in the image that I'm seeing, because it seems like everything is sort of slapped together, which seems like the attitude that David took. You know, I think he was so focused on trying to make up for the over reduction of his sauce that maybe the plating, at least it was not on Kelsey level. So yeah, I'll admit, Kurt, I was a little surprised that David went home as well. I thought this might have been Eddie's time to go, just because he had been so on the bottom. And essentially, the debate came down to, as Jonathan Waxman eloquently put, was basically like, who screwed up cooking the challenge versus who, in their opinion, half-assed the challenge. Emily, do you agree that, in your opinion, Eddie took a more laconic approach to this challenge?
I mean, didn't Eddie, wasn't this the episode where he was stayed in the lineup and they're like, Eddie, over here, you weren't, your name wasn't called.
Yeah, poor Eddie.
Like,
well, I think he was just on the, end. He was on the far end standing there. And yeah,
he was just like zoned out. So I feel bad. I mean, I think that he just got a little too much in his head about this.
Mm-hmm. Josh, who do you think, who were you expecting to go home out of the three?
I'm always expecting Eddie to go home. Like, I'm waiting for the moment for it to happen, and I'm praying that it doesn't happen ever, because he's just been a source of true delight for me this season, in a season that I have been on the record saying is not my favorite in Top Chef history. But I thought that Eddie's dish seemed like the weakest. It seemed like it was the weakest. He clearly had like a very serious music memory attached to it. And so maybe like that passion for why he created the dish and what it was associated with maybe was enough to save him, because at least his thinking was right. And maybe it's like, all right, give him a pass. His food isn't so bad that he has to die on this one. And I do wonder, like, if he would have literally died if he had gone out on this dish that had so much emotion wrapped up into it. So a mercy for Eddie, I think. But if it had been my vote, without, you know, obviously having tasted any of this stuff, like, maybe Eddie would have been the one that I would have said, like, I don't know, man, that doesn't seem so great.
It felt like he sort of felt that way too. Like when he invited the judges, people like, yeah, I don't know why I added the butter sauce at the end. Like, it feels like, and I think he feels this way every time, much like you do, that he's essentially going home every time he appears in front of the judges. So he seemed like, I don't know. He's like, yeah, butter poaching the red snapper was a mistake. I know. And it seemed like he was ready to pack his bags only for David to go home here. I mean, Tom is going to sort of give away his own criteria, the ranking of it, where when he comes to analyzing dishes, first thing is going to be, is it cooked well? Second is going to be, is it seasoned well? And third is going to be, does it adhere to the challenge? And maybe it's just because Kelsey's and David's were both so oversalted that first priority outranks the third one. And that's why Eddie stays. I'm not entirely sure. I'm still trying to sort of piece it together, but I guess that's the appeal, in a manner of speaking, of Top Chef, is that we are not there. We're not the judges. We don't make these decisions. And Eddie lives to squirm another day, much like the puff rice on his meat.
But also wondering to what extent the chef testant's reaction to the judge's critique is. So if somebody is very defensive and I just don't see it, or I tasted it and it was fine, I wonder, so if a chef testant pushes back more, versus you have like an Eddie who seems like very contrite and open to the critiques and like, you know what, I messed up. I wonder if that's where, how that affects the rankings in the judges' minds. Mm.
What do you think about that, Emily?
I mean, yeah, it's, I mean, I agree with Kurt. It's just, yeah.
Well, let's eulogize David a bit, because I think if we had said in episode two, much like a lot of these chef testants, that David would have been eliminated before the final five, we would have been surprised, considering the tear that he went on. He was the top in the first elimination challenge, won the next two quick fires, but we sort of been talking about this the past few weeks. He started to hit a bit of a slump, and not that he was necessarily winding up in the bottom, but he was not cooking the fantastic food he was putting out in the very beginning, and it culminated in a finish here. I think it would have been embarrassing for anyone to go out for a personal memory challenge, but David, most of all, they talk about him Last Chance Kitchen, how I don't think his Portuguese family is going to, they're going to have a lot to mock him about in terms of him going out trying to cook his family's food, essentially. Josh, can you eulogize David for me as a Top Chef testant?
I really liked him, and I loved the connection with Colicchio. Like, I loved that they had like that same hometown roots that they would be able to bond over. I'll miss that. LCK is a thing. I am aware of this. And it wouldn't shock me at all to see him find his way back into the competition at some point down the line. There's just like, you know, it's like, it can just be like a feel thing, and that doesn't always work the best in Top Chef, which is, I think, a testament to the fairness of the competition, that like, he just has that aura of one of these personalities this season that we're not done with that person's story. But who knows? I may be wrong, and we'll never see him back on the show proper again, but I wouldn't be shocked to see him find his way back into the final stretch of the main proper Top Chef.
What do you think, Kurt?
Yeah, he was, you know, the quickfire king for like the early part of the episode, the early part of the season, and, you know, is very obviously, I think, has been portrayed as one of the big fans of the show, who's on the show proper. I think, you know, he's kind of like a new Jim's in that way, I'd say. So I would not be surprised, given his enthusiasm for being on the show, that I would not be surprised if we saw him back.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that it seemed like every time there was a guest judge, he was the one who was geeking out. He was basically treating the judges like Kelsey treats Hunter Hayes. Like, especially, we talked about it when Brooke was on with Richard Blaze, that he was freaking out. You know, he talked about that with a couple of the guest judges in the past few episodes. Emily, do we think we're going to be missing out on that ebullience in the next couple of episodes if David's truly gone?
Yeah, I think he's like, you know, like waving the flag of Top Chef. So it's sad to see him go. But like what you guys just said, I completely agree with. Like, if there's anybody that's going to come back, I would not be surprised to see his face. So yeah, we'll see.
I completely agree, especially because we'll segue into LCK here. Spoiler alert, Tom tells David at the end of LCK that he only has two rounds left before he gets a chance to come back into the competition. So, you know, I feel like the people who came back in the past couple seasons, like Joe Flam and Brooke only had to cook one round to get back. I think Joe Flam had to get through like two, maybe. So there is something to say about those, that it's not an exact revolving door, but when you go so far as to only have a couple of rounds to need to cook your way back, I think that definitely benefits him. And let's segue into LCK here. Kurt, set up for me what this week's Last Chance Kitchen Challenge is.
So they kind of dubbed it UFOs, unidentified food objects. And again, plays back to, if for any reason this is your first time watching LCK, they go back to the reason that the chef lost in the main competition and come up with some inspired, theme for the LCK competition. So given that David's dish, that Tom and some of the judges were unable to tell what was what, they wheeled out a cart of ingredients, but none of the ingredients were labeled in packaging or in their natural state. Sometimes they'd be chopped up and blended. And so basically you had a table full of mystery items, and the chefs had to rely on their, well, you know, either what the ingredient looked like, but, you know, most importantly, what they could kind of taste of it to figure out what they could make with it. And so I actually personally thought this was a really interesting and innovative challenge where you're completely, relying on their knowledge of flavor profiles from having to taste the food to figure out, or the ingredient to figure out what to do with
it. Yeah, I really love this challenge, but it also reminded me, can we get the taste test challenge back? I kind of want that to be a part of every season.
I wouldn't mind that. I like the, like, you know, blindfold and identify this ingredient. So that's what this reminded me of that quite a bit as well.
Yeah, Emily, you're a big food person. What are your thoughts on that idea of just like challenges like this, purely interpreting things just by the way you taste them and sort of guessing in the dark as to what it might be used for?
I love that strategy. I'd like to see it on Top Chef proper. I mean, why not see everybody struggling to figure this out as a quick fire? I think that would be really fun. And you know, kind of like, once again, helping to see whose strengths are illustrated in handling a lot of ingredients they're not necessarily familiar with, or if they are, but they just can't taste it. Like mystery meat. Love that. That's great. Yeah. I want to see that.
Yeah. I think that probably the biggest thing, I think it totally, makes the challenge worthy of being shown, is the fact that David picks a jar of what he thinks are nuts, but are actually ground up sugar cookies. Which is insane. But again, it speaks towards like the fun thing about these blind taste tests as well, are that like if you rob someone of either knowledge or a sense, like they'll go into crazy places. And I do love the production as well for going so far as to grind up sugar cookies and put them out there. And I'm sure they're happy that David grabbed what is probably the most wild card ingredient of them all.
It reminds me of a really great scene in the 1990s action movie Demolition Man, starring Sylvester Stallone, when he and Sandra Bullock and Benjamin Bratt are going into the underground section of Los Angeles so that they can meet Dennis Leary's resistance leader. And as they are down there, they are eating. There's all sorts of like kind of grungy partying going on, and they're serving up burgers. And all such food is outlawed in the above world, in the surface world, which is much more like of a utopian place, or an attempt at a utopia, where Taco Bell is the most important, prestigious meal that you can get.
Speaking
and
of
Sylvester
mystery.
Stallone. Yes. And Sylvester Stallone, who has been thawed from at least 30 or so years of being frozen in prison. He is so excited to be eating a burger, and he starts eating the burger and he's loving. And somebody informs him like, yo, Sylvester Stallone, that's a rat burger. The meat is rat. And he goes, it's a rat burger? This is a pretty good rat burger. And it's like that kind of idea of like, if you don't know you're eating a rat burger, but it's really tasty, and then you find out that it's a rat burger, are you going to be upset that you're eating rat, or are you going to be delighted that you just enjoyed a rat burger?
Yeah, I mean, essentially this challenge were the three seashells, where you don't exactly know what they're used for, but they're put in front of you and you have to use them.
And you get that unique moment where they're presenting the dishes to Tom. He's like, well, what I think you're eating is, and then they list off the name of the dish, or the supposed dish. So I liked the fact that, you know, Brandon gets, you know, figures out right away is that this isn't a challenge where you know that is, sun chokes on the table, and your mind immediately starts to think about, you know, well, what kind of dishes can I use this for? It's like, you literally have to, you know, rely on your, like, oh, this tastes kind of within this family, and this would, I'm looking for a flavor that would pair with it. Oh, that's not quite that flavor. So it's this complete knowledge of flavor profiles based on tasting the ingredient versus coming to the table with any knowledge of just what you would normally use a known ingredient. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah. So the two big surprises come from each side here. We talked about David's nuts actually being ground up sugar cookies. Brandon's mystery meat turns out to be Spam, which I believe they've actually pretty recently used like in a challenge in terms of a meat alternative to use. So he was happy though to not know that he's not using Spam. Kurt, were you surprised with the outcome here of David beating Brandon in the end?
It's just in terms of, like Tom said, it was just a more well-crafted dish what David had put together, and I kind of see where he was going with that. I mean, I love me an empanada. I would have definitely wanted to, you know, to try that, but I think David potentially navigated the challenge a little bit better in terms of what he chose to present.
Yeah, because I think Brandon picked the mystery meat along with mango and artichokes. Or was it sunchokes? But it didn't feel like either one of those was really a part of the dish.
He thought they were sunchokes initially, but then he said that they were artichokes. But what he presented ended up he being labeled as a kale chimichurri, and I'm not sure how that ended up on the plate, but I don't know. It's again, I would have probably been more drawn to try the empanada, but given I think the structure of the challenge, I can see why if it was really, really, really close in terms of flavor, I could see why Tom went with David.
Yeah, whether it was a sunchoke or an artichoke, he seemed to choke slightly in this challenge. I don't know. I'm a big fan of scallops, so I think David's scallops with the romesco and the cauliflower puree, and again, another cauliflower done two ways, and some apples in there provide some nice freshness. It seemed like he put some jalapeno as well to sort of give a nice kick at the end. So I think it's understandable why David ends up winning here, and as we talked about, I think he's well poised to make a return appearance. Anything else about this episode before we look ahead to what dramatically might be coming next on Top Chef?
No, I'm just really excited to find out what the origin of Don't Call Me Mama, Call Me Sarah is. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, so talk about that a bit. So it looks like they're going 3-on-3. It looks like we're doing a basketball-themed challenge here in honor of the University of Kentucky. So it looks like Adrian and Sarah are on different teams. They're going to basically be making chicken and waffles. And it seems like Adrian, particularly with Justin on the sidelines, I think they're spreading some rumors about Sarah using waffle mix to make her waffles, which, as we talked about, is sort of like a no-go in Top Chef, especially at the Final Seven. And Sarah's pissed. Sarah's emotional about it. So I think that we haven't seen a lot of internal conflict, really, outside of like the stuff that happened at Restaurant Wars. But Emily, we might be seeing our dose of it next week.
I know. It looks a little contentious. It looks a little rough.
Especially since Adrian still might be sick. So that probably doesn't help things either.
Adrian's like, I just can't kick it. No, I'm interested to see what happens. It's, using a boxed mix of anything. Like, waffles aren't that hard to make. I don't know.
Yeah, again, I'm Kwame, the aforementioned Kwame.
Yeah.
Frozen waffles. I don't know what it is about waffles, but it causes chefs to literally waffle on this rule.
Mike.
There were so many tones I got in that one word, and I just expressed so many opinions.
That's the power of it. Now you understand the babe text.
Yeah.
Now I've been babed, and I love it. I love it.
Oh, yes. Man, it's good.
Well, we shall see next week who comes out of this heated match on both on and off the court as Top Chef makes its way back to Kentucky. It was a fun little day trip to Nashville, but I'm happy to be back as we will be back next week. Follow all these lovely individuals on Twitter. Kirk Clark is at Kirk Clark with two C's. Emily Fox is at Emlet, like omelet that David tried to make with an E. Josh is at Round Howard. I am at a Mike Bloom type. Josh, I know this has been a big week for you and Survivor fans everywhere.
Oh my goodness. First One Out is out. The entire season of the fourth First One Out is available on Rob Has a Podcast. So if you're a Survivor fan and you want to get into the preseason and you want to listen in and hear who's competing for the $1 million prize this year, you can do that in its entirety. Just a meat and potatoes cast preview. None of the bells and whistles that are usually associated with First One Out. It's very lean and mean. Hope you enjoy it. Check it out. RobHasAPodcast.com.
Well, if Hunter Hayes can just love meat and corn and peppers, I think people can love your bare bones take on fantastic First One Out.
Thank you. I hope so. And if not, don't tell me about it. Don't at me.
I know you can check out the Top Chef exit press that I'm doing as well. I haven't spoken with David yet, but I did put up my interview with Brian, where I think he was very candid about not only his experience on the boat, but his frustrations that he had near the end of his time at Top Chef. So he was a really interesting person to talk to. I'll be sure to have David up as well before the next episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Let us know your thoughts about this challenge. These chefs, are you thumbs up or thumbs up the butt about them? Be sure to let us know. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back next week covering some basketball-infused Top Chef challenges. But for now, you may pack your knives and go.